Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thanks very much for the invitation to talk today. The topic I've been asked to address is the Behaviour Change Network. What I wanted to do was give you a bit of an update on that, but I've got an exam question as well, which is the risks of negative compensatory behaviour. Just a bit about, so you know about my evidence-based prejudices. I'm Chief Executive of the National Heart Forum, which is a membership of 70 national organisations focusing on the primary prevention of all chronic diseases and linked conditions. We're essentially a policy development organisation with a predominant focus on the upstream determinants of health and disease and take an ecological approach. This is the purpose of the talk, and I'm wearing a number of hats today, and I apologise for some of the slides. That's my sense of humour, but it's better than my jokes. And the update on the Behaviour Change Network is very much early days, because this has only really started to sort of scope out what's being done and take forward a programme of work. So I'll give you a health warning. I'm not a behavioural expert. There are many in the audience who are far more competent than I am on this subject, and I'm reminded by Mark Twain whenever I read health books. So, you know, basically, what's this all about? Well, it's this new central idea, the more sophisticated approach to behaviour change, particularly taking novel ideas and seeing that has any public health impact. I think it's important to realise, though, that there is an ideological perspective to this, and there is an aversion to regulation. I'm going to come back to that at the very end of my presentation. And the new central idea, again, is about partnerships, which means all things to all people. And I think what we have to ask ourselves is, this is necessary, but is it sufficient to tackle the determinants of disease and health in isolation? So the traditional approach is, you know, this. It speaks for itself. You know, then again, there's the role of the state, and there's the issues, the ideologies and views about this, you know, the role of the nanny state. Although the people who most complain about the nanny state are people who can afford nannies. And then we have, you know, the classic sort of messages. How are these messages actually interpreted? And how do we deal with that from the point of view of behaviour change, both at individual and population level? Well, the responsibility deal consists of five networks. These are the headlines on alcohol, food, activity, physical activity, workplace, and behaviour change. And really, it's a partnership or a mechanism for dialogue, particularly between civil society and commercial operators. And it's predicated on voluntary action, on the fact that it's faster and further and will go more widespread than other means and mechanisms available to the state. Essentially, most of the pledges or the commitments to action are from industry, and the role of the civil society is to hold the feet to the fire of the commercial players, but also governments as well, to make sure they're high health impact areas and meaningful pledges and commitments. There is also independent monitoring and evaluation of the deal as a whole, and there's a plethora of commitments, but there will be a focus on particular commitments to see how effective they've been. I think it's also important to realise there are very limited resources available to the deal. They are essentially resources around the table and the resources they have access to because of the resource challenge times we're in. And these few slides sort of demonstrate some of... I told you my sense of humour was appalling. Demonstrate some of the dynamics there are within the responsibility deal between the civil society and the different sectors. Partnerships, the ideology that pals are forever. Keep friends close. So these are the sorts of issues. And sometimes you feel like this, either if you're from the corporate sector or you're from the civil society sector, because you very much are being challenged both ways. So just on the behaviour, so those dynamics, it's early days. The responsibility deal itself, I would argue, is an experiment. I'm going to talk quite a lot about experiments as we go through this. But I would say about the Behaviour Change Network, it's different from the other networks because it's a pledge-free zone. And it's the experimental type. It's looking at the behavioural theories and how they might be applied. And the people on the network, the theory is that they're a resource to the other networks to help them take forward their meaningful commitments in the most effective ways. And the work of the network is focusing on developing experiments at this stage natural experiments, but those that have high public health impact and can be scaled up and make sure there are no negative consequences, which I'll come on to in a moment. And the way our thinking on this is that it should be researcher-led, and it's very important to have proper ground rules on this, particularly engaging in sectors where themselves they might wish to, if you're a conspiracy theorist, have some compensatory behaviour themselves. So compensatory behaviour can happen at the individual and the organisational level. The network is also trying to stimulate research investment and finding ways to do that, particularly with the NIHR programme. And it's also has links with the Cabinet Office and the new MRC unit headed by Theresa Martou. Also, it's going to be cognizant of the work of the NICE review on behaviour change, which will go out for consultation soon in terms of scope, which has been been prompted to have a review of the existing guidance because of the excellent House of Lords behaviour change review. Ethics and behaviour change, I'm going to come on to that a bit later, but that's obviously quite an important issue. And what I want to cover is some of the fundamental laws of public health that need to be applied to this area. The initial focus has been on the retail sector and also looking at other network priorities. The retail sector, because it brings a lot of these areas together, and it is a very powerful sector for influencing health behaviours. The other network priorities around calorie reduction and reducing the alcoholic strength of alcoholic beverages. One of the things we also want to do is get access to commercial data in a non-compromising way that doesn't compromise any of the commercial players or affect their competitive advantage. And that's going to be quite a challenge because, in a way, if we're going to look at the commercial sector, then they're clearly sitting on a very useful database, which you could argue could be developed into a sort of definitive evidence base that's untapped at the moment, particularly in terms of how things are designed in the retail sector, what we do and don't know about the influence on purchasing behaviour. But I'm going to talk about compensatory. The exam question was compensatory behaviour. And just, I hope I'm not stealing Laura's slides here, am I? No. There are lots of key insights. You can change behaviour without changing minds. And if we look at the Nobel laureates and so on, they also refer to the environmental effects on behaviour. And we have many other gurus in this area. And we've got quite a few books on nudge, which Laura's going to talk about a lot more. But the one I want to refer to particularly, which we found useful in the behaviour change group, is Mindspace, which has been around for some time now. But it brings together a lot of the behavioural theories and psychosocial theories in terms of, it's a useful mnemonic in terms of understanding behaviours and thinking through how you might tackle these issues. I'm not going to dwell on this at the moment, but particularly looking at nudge theories, looking at novel ideas in which you can actually influence behaviour. This is a piano which plays music as you go up. This is on the website. It was developed in Sweden. But the important thing to remember about behaviour change is that it's not always a rational thing. It's a reflective system. It's also an automatic system. And this is important when we think about modern marketing, because when we're talking about behaviour change, we've got to think of lots of the commercial nudges, and what we probably should be thinking about is re-engineering some of the existing environmental cues that we have. Other issues when you look at behaviour change is we need to consider addictions and how that applies to our modern lifestyles and the life stage as well, how this changes through the life course. But essentially, the choice architecture and choice editing, and that's where it gets controversial. So, and this applies across all the tobacco areas. If we look at some of them, then do we know the answers to these questions? I mean, for example, if we reduce the strength of lots of alcoholic drinks, will it lead to an alcohol career to move up for a higher strength? Low-calorie drinks, will it still create a craving for sugary drinks, which we know are very important in terms of disease consequences? Sensible drinking limits, what is the message? Are we drinking up to the sensible drinking limits every day? How do we actually communicate that? Snus, I mean, there is a move to get these these products, you know, the market open. But will that lead on to, you know, cigarette smoking? What do we know about those things? Sweeteners, does that continue to keep our sweetness alive and encourage that appetite, if not addiction? Substituting, when we're substituting behaviours, we have to look at the consequence of that. Portion size, do we really know if that's going to reduce calorie intake? Dieting, I mean, if self-efficacy, lots of people who diet know perfectly well it has this yo-yo effect and affects self-efficacy in terms of people's understanding of whether it's effective or not. That's the real experience. Most of the experiments on dieting show you actually increase weight, not decrease. Cycle helmets, you know, how does that affect people's behaviour? Does it make them more reckless? So these are the sorts of questions that public health people have to ask. Essentially, what are the adverse and perverse outcomes or consequences of what you're trying to do? Are you in danger of sometimes creating bigger problems? And it's very important to look at interrelated behaviours. So mitigating risks, having said all that, I mean, the answer to the exam question would be as follows, I think. Basically, you need full behavioural insight analysis and you need to test interventions before scaling up for the reasons that I've just mentioned. And really, you need to, if you're doing it at a population level, then you need population level predictions on the basis of those natural experiments. And that for the ground rules to be sure that you don't get any compensation by particular interests, it's very important that it's done by as researcher-led experience. From this point of view, you need clear ground rules on how you take this forward in commercial settings, which is the stage we're at on the behaviour change group. What are the ground rules? How does that operate? With social marketing, again, it's about market segmentation at the population level. But the critical issue is sustainability. Support for choice for environmental change is really important because one thing we know in public health is that truth is important. You have to provide people, this comes back to the ethics, with accurate information. And if that's ever found to be slightly spun or untrue, then it ends up you end up going backwards and can have a very negative reaction. And there are countless examples in public health. So compensatory behaviours at individual and organisational levels. Business behaviours, because of the consumption conundrum, which is what we're faced with on the responsibility deal. Many of the professional NGOs want to reduce consumption in key areas, whereas the business partners, quite rightly, they're in the business to increase consumption. So how do you actually take that forward? And many people are thinking about this moving from shareholder value to, for example, shared value model, where you look at the social economic nature of the community and how you serve the community as a key stakeholder. One of the ways of mitigating risk is to have clear conflicts of interest rules in terms of how you take this forward. This is a particular example which was developed around the UN meeting last year on NCDs, about how these relationships can be governed in the public interest. The realities are, though, if we take something like obesity, you know, the realities of asking people to change their behaviour are quite formidable when we look at the obesogenic environment and the way that our genetics is not capable of modifying in terms of the environmental changes that we're confronted with, as we've seen with the inexorable increase of obesity since the 1980s. So just to look at the scale of the problem, you know, and this comes back to the proportionate response that we should have and the measures we should use. This is a typical, local authority area and the scale of the problem, which continues to increase. So we have to really look at behaviour in relation to the broader determinants of health. These sorts of determinants, it's naive not to. One of the areas that we're looking at the Health Heart Forum is in these market-shaping measures, if we're talking about the commercial environment, how do you create a health-creating economy and one that's not damaging, particularly in relation to certain industries? And these are the sorts of measures that you might actually put in place, market-shaping measures. And I would suggest that we should look at market-shaping measures as a very different language from regulation, especially as an aversion to the language of regulation. And there were some interesting observations made recently by the Cabinet Secretary about how we describe these things and that it's quite legitimate for the state to do these, provided there's permission to do them. And they're not new ideas. It goes right back to, you know, the development of capitalism and the whole debates about responsible capitalism. you know, about there are ways the state can intervene. But even like this, for example, taxation, it's very important to look out the adverse and perverse outcomes before you do this. And there's lots of experiments around Europe at the moment which should be watched very carefully in relation to taxes and subsidies around food and need to be very well worked through and modelled first. And then there's the physical environment. This is an example of a publication we produced about the sorts of things that really do matter, which can support the behaviour change and minimise any negative consequences. Building design, hope most people use the stairs here today, but clearly signposting them. Outdoor space, the availability of that for everybody. Urban green space, walking and cycling, making sure the right infrastructure is there. I think we're going to hear a bit more of this in a moment. Sharing the public realm and the way we design that, and it's shared space, not just car corridors. That's not the end quite. The challenges and opportunities are, I sort of reviewed the approach by the Behaviour Change Network. As I said, it's early days, but that's the sort of strategic direction we're taking. I hope it's given you some insight into some of the dilemmas, the dynamics and opportunities. And what I, as a public health practitioner, consider the primary laws of public health, that what you choose should at the very least not cause any harm, that truth's really important in terms of ethics, and you should have permission to do what you do at a population level, and strengthen the resolve of policymakers to have a more comprehensive range of measures. Experiment before you scale up. It's very important to use theory and novel ideas, but be sure they're part of a broader range of measures to assure sustainability. And remember, the RD is an experiment, and maybe, this is my behavioural theory, maybe we should look at aversion theory in therapy in terms of some political behaviour. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.